From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the November edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month, our bomb experts are taken to task by a veteran, women in cybersecurity, or the lack of them. And we meet some communication historians with fascinating collections on show in the mansion. But first, we donned hard hats and high-vis to find out how the restoration of Bletchley Park is progressing. We said a few months ago that Block C was starting to look like its old self, but now it's really coming back to life. We took a floor-to-ceiling tour of the rapidly progressing work, and we were given rare access underneath the scaffolding covering huts 3 and 6. So we're sheltering from the rain under the scaffolding between huts 3 and 6. I'm with Rob Davies, Fairhurst Ward Abbott's site manager, and conservation architect Janie Price with Kennedy O'Callaghan. So tell me where we're up to.
We've now basically encased the huts with a scaffold and a tin roof to protect them from the elements. The challenge was with that normally you would tie a scaffold to the building you're scaffolding. The problem we've had here is because the huts are quite fragile, we've had to build a very large independent scaffold. And that requires huge water buttresses which tie the scaffold down. Hence why we've got this rather grand scaffold towering over Bletchley Park at the moment.
Much bigger than the buildings themselves, obviously.
Yeah, indeed. So it's a lot quicker to re-roof, and also means that we aren't going to damage any of the original fabric in the building. To make the building safe to work on, where we'd had a lot of rotten sole plate, we went around and repaired all that to stabilise the structure, which then allowed us safe access to get the scaffold up and get the roofers onto the roof. We've then stripped all the original roof coverings off, and we've put back new sarking boards where they've been rotten. To be honest, the huts, in their essence, they were pretty good. You know, if the roof had stayed intact, they would have probably wouldn't have been such disrepair.
Janie, last time we spoke, you were saying if only you'd gotten here a few months earlier.
Well, every time I came, I was being rained on inside just as much as outside. It was pretty horrendous.
I just have, actually.
And one of the challenges that we had as well was that the huts are so fragile that we had to either work bay by bay or prop and secure the huts as we went. And on hut 3, where we had asbestos cladding and it all had to be removed, we had to make sure that we braced each bay before we did the next bay. So it was quite arduous, and FWA, and Rob in particular, have got their heads around how to brace and prop as they go, so that they're progressing at quite a good rate.
And is it getting to the point now, Rob, where it's getting quite satisfying to see what you have achieved, or does it still feel like you've got a huge mountain to climb?
Do you know what? I think we're over the west with the huts now. It was always that concern is that we didn't really know what we were getting into until we started removing cladding and pulling things apart, looking behind plasterboard. So there's always that concern about how much work we did have against us. But to be honest, we're looking good. Yeah, all the repairs in Hut 6 are pretty much complete. We've replaced plasterboard where we needed to. We've left as much of the original as we can. Even to the point where some of the paintwork was flaking, rather than having to replace the plasterboard, what we've done is we've stabilised the flaking paint with a PVA. We've painted over it. So we've tried to keep as much of the original fabric there as we could. All the floor repairs have been done. New floor joists have gone into Hut 6. And we've actually managed to salvage floorboards from some huts at Fawley Court. They've all been put back in now, and we'll also be putting some of the shiplap from Fawley Court onto the gable end of Hut 6.
And that survived in better nick than what we had here then?
Yes, we had it heat treated before it came to make sure we weren't bringing any damp or bug-ridden timbers or anything out, so we know it's safe to put into the building.
One of the challenges we've got is that it's only 1.5 metres long, which isn't really long enough, so we're going to have butt board joints, which we wouldn't have previously had. But it's still better to reuse recycled wartime timber than to get new.
Yeah, and it's created a nice story, and actually also it's created a nice effect to the hut, actually. If you put new floorboards in, it's very evident there's new floorboards, but so it's kept the atmosphere of the hut, I think.
An enormous amount of planning went into this, of course, but it sounds like you're making decisions constantly that you couldn't make at the planning stage, that you're
Absolutely.
Having to, as you go along.
Definitely, yes. We've pre-planned as much as we possibly can, and we've written into our specification the way we wanted to go, and we've done very detailed structural specification drawings and notes, but most of it has to just be agreed by word of mouth and drawing on walls and so on as we go.
Judgment on the day.
Yeah. Yes.
Can you show me then?
Yeah, we can have a walk through and look.
More spiffy than I remember it.
Coming on, actually, yeah. So, now inside hut six, we're going to start with the electrics now. Because all the electrics are surface run and we're going to have black conduits coming down, we've had to paint the walls. So we've done all our repair work, we've put a mist coat of the colour all over the walls so we can run our black conduits down the walls so it's easier for the decorators when we come to finish. Pretty much all the floorboards in the corridor are the four-leaf quartz floorboards. Most of the decay was on the west elevation of the building, so we pretty much lost all our floor joists, all the floorboards, and had lost most of the sole plate at that side of the building, whereas the east elevation had stayed in good condition. There was very little repair to do in there. The other thing we discovered with the huts, which was quite odd, that where the upright stud walls was positioned onto the footings didn't meet with where the footings were, which we couldn't really understand because we were always told that the huts were built on site. But what it would seem is that they were prefabricated because they probably put the footings in, brought the prefabricated huts here, found that they didn't match where they put their footings, but they had to go up quickly. They didn't have time to change the footings. That's how it looks. Because the building hasn't moved that much. It's just how they built it over where their footings are.
Right, it's a good example of how they weren't thinking long-term in any way. It was immediate need, wasn't it? And to get this building up and get people in it.
Yeah. Yes, and it gives us a few challenges of how to waterproof the base where the footing kicks out and isn't covered by the cladding. So we've come up with a special detail which is going to be a little bit laborious to install, but we've decided how we're going to protect that now.
Obviously, that's some of the challenges. You want to put back everything as it was, which we've managed to do in most instances, but where the building's failed, of course, we want to give the building some lifespan, so we will have to do some slight changes to things like weatherproofing and drip details and around the perimeter of the building.
To not end up in the same situation again.
And to cut maintenance costs for Bletchley Park.
Yeah. You have to be flexible, don't you, with this kind of thing? You can't put it back exactly as it was.
Yes, and where we can't, sometimes we've just taken the attitude that we have to do it in the spirit of how they would have done it at the time, had they had the materials available. We're not changing anything unless we have to. As Rob said, we have to have a very good reason in order to change something. For example, a previous failure, or for example where we can't replace asbestos, we're using the next best thing, which is very similar to how it originally looked.
So it sounds like kind of threw it together in haste, which I think we knew, but now you're seeing very detailed evidence of that.
It is becoming more and more evident in some places. Yes, definitely. Yeah. We've primed all the doors up, we've put the floorboards down, it's more just electrics going through the building now, and once the roof is finished, which is halfway through, we can drop the scaffold. We're going to then remove the paint off the huts. There's several ways you can take the paint off. One is using chemicals. We don't like using chemicals. You could also use a hot torch, but we've got a nice, very dry timber hut here. We don't use hot torches on the timber. So there's a new way of doing that. It's called dry ice blasting, which basically is just a high-pressure gun that fires nitrous oxide onto the timber. It'll hit the paint. That paint freezes and just falls to the ground. So it's a quick and safe way of removing all the paint.
But we have to be very careful because the existing paint has a very high lead content.
These buildings are a death trap one way or another.
Yeah.
It's amazing we were able to bring them back to life.
Fortunately, guys working on building sites these days are very well trained in asbestos awareness, in dust awareness, and working in different types of materials and old materials, because often they're doing conservation work, that's they come across these items, so they all know what they're looking for. So more often than not, if they find something, they can tell us straight away and get a specialist in to remove it.
There's an example of one of the original light fittings, which we think might be towards the end of the war, but it's a glass shade, and we have managed to salvage about 30 of them, some were in Block C and some elsewhere. We've got some wartime photographs of Block D, which show the same type of fitting, and so we're going to use those as the base of what to install in both huts 3 and 6. So each room will have one of those. Where we've got the original Bakelite fittings still intact on the ceiling, we're going to leave those intact and put the new light alongside. But where it isn't, we'll put them in the original location, which is just one in the centre of each room.
Where have you sourced these from?
Light Inc. is the name of the company. They bespoke all the light fittings. They've also made the ones in Hut 11 and Block C, which are based on the historic photographs that we just drew to scale.
When was the last time you were in then?
It's a while ago.
Changing a bit?
Yes. I don't think transformation would be an overstatement. I haven't been in here for a while.
Things are going great guns now. Everything's sort of coming to that point where everything's starting to come together. We've got an awful lot of guys on site. We've got a region around sort of 45 to 50 people working on site at any one time. Probably about 25 guys working just within Block C. We've got electricians here, heating engineers, window fitters. We've got guys up at the moment putting all the new battens up for the acoustic ceiling tiles. We managed to salvage 5,500 of the original acoustic ceiling tiles in the building. But what we've done is we've taken them down so we can run in some of the new services in behind them. We've increased the size of the batten that they sat on. Those battens are now pretty much in throughout the building. And then we've moved back the original acoustic ceiling tiles, and we've managed to source another 8,000 that we need from the US that pretty much are an exact match.
And so they'll be going up as well. So
obviously theirs are still Imperial, which helps.
Yes. We did try and get them from the UK. We would have had to get them made especially, and that would have been obviously a huge cost.
Huge expense.
But we haven't managed to get the 8,000 shipped in from the US.
Last time I came in here, there was a section of the granite floor that had been polished up, and you were considering what would happen with the rest of it, having sort of established the quality of it.
We did a sample area for Bletchley Park to have a look at, because we
it
were
looked
all
like very expensive worktop. It was very fancy.
Well, we managed to polish one area up to you get different grits that you use, so you start off at 100 grit, then 800. So what we saw was a 3,000 grit. This is like a sort of car showroom finish. The problem we had with that is that we had to do a slip resistance test. And unfortunately, when it was wet, it was very slippery, so we couldn't go for that. So we've had to go for a more matte finish. But that's probably, to be honest, a lot more what it was like in 1942. We were going to put a brown lino down. We did find some original brown lino in the building, so it could have been that they had brown lino in some areas for comfort and just the granolithic floor that we found in others. So Bletchley Park saw this floor and they were so excited about it, we didn't really want to cover it up. All the floors throughout the building now have been ground down, cleaned up, and now that's why you can see all over the floor now we've got a floor protection, just protecting from any stainage or any damage where the guys are working in here. And also it means it's very low maintenance for Bletchley Park.
It's quite a good example, isn't it, of how much money was thrown at this phase of the building work. There we were with the prefabricated, thrown together, flung up in a hurry wooden hut just now. And now here we are where they've got granolithic floors and acoustic ceiling tiles and much more expensive and lavish buildings.
It's a much higher specification. But one of the interesting things that we discovered when we got some paint analysis done was that they still didn't have very much money and or very many materials available. And the paint's very, very yellow. And the reason for that is that they watered them down with a lot of turfs, which made it go very yellow.
So what's next in here?
The restored windows are all going back in it as we speak. The electrics and the mechanical, the heating is probably 2/3 of the way in. Very close to looking at all the finishes now. Toilet cubicles, tiling.
Doors. All being refurbished.
Yeah, all the timber works. So.
All the ironmongery has been sent off for repairing.
It's all the finishing items that we're looking at now. So that's the exciting part when all the building starts to really sort of close in and feel a bit more close to the finished article.
The mansion was festooned with historic radios, televisions and other communication devices during one weekend in October. Are You Listening celebrated communication throughout Bletchley Park's history. From the post office and carrier pigeons to radio waves and the first televisions, right up to the age of computers and the internet.
Hi, I'm Graham Perry, member of Milton Keynes Amateur Radio Society, or MCARS for short. My call sign is G7OSR. MCARS exists for the promotion of amateur radio within the Milton Keynes area. We have members from all over this area, stretching up to Northampton, out to Buckingham, and down as far as Hemel Hempstead, and over as far as Bedford. We're here today with a number of exhibits. We have the MCARS 80, a kit-built amateur radio transceiver, which is very low cost, simple to build, and is very popular amongst many amateurs all over the world, from Russia to Australia.
And where can people find out more information about this kit?
More details about this amazing little radio can be found at www.radio-kits.co.uk/MCARS80. But also you can get information from the Milton Keynes Amateur Radio Society website, which is at www.mkars.org.uk, or you can Google MCARS 80. Milton Keynes Amateur Radio Society meet every Tuesday evening from about 7:30 to 9:30 at Longyearville Hall in Newton Longville. There we meet, discuss the issues of the day concerning radio. We also have an active contester who involves himself in radio contests for the club. The club also support activities in the community. This year we were at the Newton Longville Festival of Transport with an exhibit there. We also have a radio rally which we held at Newton Longville, which is like a radio car boot sale, but it's a little bit more than that, as there are traders and exhibitors from various aspects of the radio community. Amateur radio, it's based on an interest in radio and the magic of radio. I've always described it as radio is the magic of the 20th century, doing it without wires. And those of us that are fascinated with this seek to learn more about it and its uses. And its uses are many, from Morse, speech. We also use digital data modes to connect a computer to a transmitter and receiver and send various, not encoded, but coded signals across the world. In November, there will be an amateur radio satellite launched from a Russian cosmodrome, which will be controlled and monitored from a site here on Bletchley Park. Amateur radio has had satellites up for about 50 years now. The first one was a large aluminiumized balloon which people would fire signals at and listen for the reflections. We also do things like Earth, Moon, Earth, where radio amateurs specialize in high-powered transmitters and very directional antennas pointed at the moon. You fire a signal at the moon, the signal bounces off the moon and can be picked up by someone almost half the world away. It's true that a majority of radio amateurs are somewhere north of 40, but we have an active training regime at the club to bring on younger amateurs and people interested in the hobby. We run training courses, because now there's a three-tier license available for radio amateurs: foundation, intermediate and advanced. The foundation course, 9-year-olds have been known to pass the foundation course. It requires a desire to learn and an interest in the subject. The intermediate course, a little harder, with some practical aspects involving construction, soldering, the use of small tools. And the advanced course, more appreciation and a much more technical side regarding design of antennas, feeders, and giving you more of an insight as to what goes on inside the box.
I think as technology becomes more widespread, I think if a child is of that ilk, I think they do want to sort of look back, don't they, to where some of this technology's come from, and look back to amateur radio and things, and it just fills their excitement, I think, doesn't it?
I think so, for some, though our equipment here this afternoon, I mean, we have equipment over the back here from World War II, and we have equipment over here which is an SDR radio, a software-defined radio, which is pretty much up to the minute. It's a computer-controlled radio where the computer does all the signal processing in digital form, and then the small box, which is the actual radio itself, just does the bit that the computer can't do, producing audio, producing a radio frequency signal that we can output to an antenna.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Hello, I'm Greg Hewitt. I'm a member of the British Vintage Wireless Society, and we're here this weekend at Bletchley Park demonstrating many of our members' restored and working radios and television sets. We have many members from all backgrounds who are interested in the vintage technology, restoring it and also keeping it going, be that domestic radio or more military background radio. And what we try to promote within the society is to help people restore and get their sets working. We also have many meetings throughout the year where we have swap meets and auctions where members can obtain sets in both restored and unrestored conditions. And we also sell a range of spares where you can buy the spares to get the set up and running. Also, service information, circuit diagrams, originally produced by the manufacturers through the society. They're literally access to thousands of different circuit diagrams. So with a little help, anybody really could do basic restorations on a set. And obviously, as you gain experience, you can take on more challenging tasks.
I'm looking at a room filled with wood and Bakelite and just really well-made pieces of equipment.
Well, indeed, in those days, things were made by human hand more so than they are now. You'd have cabinet makers making the cabinets, the engineers working away on the electronic side of it. So, yes, there is people's blood, sweat and tears in the sets that you see around you, rather than today where something is just pumped out the end of a machine.
So what first interested you in vintage radios? Is it the design? Is it the technology?
With me personally, it was really how it worked. I mean, as a child, from the age I was probably old enough to hold a screwdriver, I was born in the early 60s, so by the early 70s, I would take the backs off radio sets, which in the 70s, valve radios were just seen as junk that people were throwing out as they upgraded to transistor. I would be fascinated by these little orange lights inside the back of the set, and I'd take things apart and stick my fingers in and get a few belts as well, but not really quite knowing what I was doing at the time. But it's a fascination that has remained with me. I suppose when people start collecting radios, they collect anything and everything. And then as the house or the workshop starts to get a little bit cluttered, a little bit overfull, you might pick on a make or an era and start getting a little more fussy in what you collect. I mean, my personal period for collecting is sort of mid-30s up to the war with radios. What you might call the golden age, when radios were made to a standard, over-engineered in many ways, whereas after the war, things were probably more so made to a price.
It's not just vintage, because a little bird told me about a little device.
Yes, obviously, there isn't a great deal to listen to on long wave and medium wave. Well, we've still got Radio 4 on long wave, but there's not a great deal to listen to on medium wave. So by using, for example, an iPod, an FM radio or a digital radio, and then using a very low-powered modulator, which in effect retransmits that signal in very, very low power, just a few feet around your radios, you can actually listen to current material or recorded material of your choice on your old radios. And this is another way of enjoying them, rather than just restoring them and sticking them up on a shelf because there's nothing to listen to.
And where can people go to find out more about the Society?
If you visit our website, www.bvws.org.uk, that has details on it. If you wish to join the Society, you can also do that through the website, or indeed at any one of our meetings. And also then you have access to our auctions and swap meets, which we do hold around the country, and the National Vintage Communications Fair every May in Warwickshire, which is open to everybody. You don't have to be a member to visit that. But if anyone arrives at the door of any of our events, we certainly wouldn't turn them away if they wish to join.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
G3VOT, G3VOT, G0TBI Portable, Bletchley Park.
G0TBI Portable, this is G3VOT in northeastern Derbyshire. My name is George, and we have a lovely afternoon, over.
Yeah, G3VOT, G0TBI Portable. Good afternoon, George. My name is Stuart, and we're located at Bletchley Park this afternoon. We're actually here with the contingent of VMARS members, the Vintage and Military Amateur Radio Society, and we're complimenting what Bletchley Park are doing this weekend for their Are You Listening weekend. I'm running 20 watts from a Harris RT138 manpack, and you're 25 to 30 over 9, George. So I wonder how you copy the manpack. A G3VOT, G0TBI stroke portable.
G0TBI stroke portable, Bletchley Park. G3VOT, absolutely astonishing.
Fine business, and fine business, of course, is a colloquial term that ham radio operators generally use when they're having fun and enjoying themselves. My name is Stuart McKinnon, and my amateur radio call sign is Golf Zero Tango Bravo India, and I'm currently the public relations officer for VMARS, the Vintage and Military Amateur Radio Society. Now, we are primarily a group of radio amateurs, shortwave listeners, collectors and restorers of old, ancient, military and vintage ham radio equipment. Now, not only ham radio equipment, but this can also spill over into the commercial world and into maritime. People are interested in VHF communications, HF radio communications, CW, Morse telegraphy, that is, line communications. using field telephones, radar, even going back to semaphore flags and heliographs. BMARS was formed in 1999. We actually had our inaugural AGM here at Bletchley Park, and I'm glad to say the people here at Bletchley Park have not got fed up with us, and we seem to return every year. We have some 450-odd members within VMARS, they're predominantly here in the UK, but we have members in Holland, Belgium, France, Australia, United States and the Far East. We have members that collect equipment from World War II right the way through to present day. Personally, myself, I do like the versatility of the collecting and operating. Operating is most important with old vintage equipment. You need to get it on the air. You need to keep those, as Tony Hancock would say, the watts throbbing through the equipment so that it doesn't sort of pack up after a year of non-use. Not only do we do things here at Bletchley Park, we're also involved with other museums and societies. Next year, for example, we're going to Blandford Forum, to the Royal Signals Museum, where we're having our 15th year celebration and our AGM. And the following day, it's the Flight Refueling Amateur Radio Society rally to Wimborne in Dorset.
Is there a website where people can find out more information?
Absolutely. I'm glad you've asked me that. The website address is www.vmars.org, and you'll find on there a nice revamped website, and there are many links on there to some of the events and activities that we do. And if they need to contact any of us within VMARS, because we're always offering our help, expertise and advice, we'd only be too pleased to help.
So what was your background into this? Was it through the military?
Absolutely. I was fortunate to be in Her Majesty's Grenadier Guards, retired as a signal colour sergeant in the early 80s, and my experience was VHF, HF communications, Morse telegraphy, teleprinter operation, and I learned to drive in the army. I did an intelligence collators course. I did a photography course. So even then, back in the late 60s, early 70s, you had to be so versatile in today's modern army. Of course, the chaps of today would run rings around me. I'm getting on a bit now, so I can't stand the pace these days, but I'm glad I still belong to my regimental association, and I'm quite proud of it as well.
And it's a nice link with Bletchley Park, because what you would have been doing in the 60s and 70s was basically following on from what had been done here.
Absolutely. The workers here at Bletchley Park were they set the ground rules for what we do today. Communication, decoding, etc. We've learnt an awful lot from the Y operators and the general service people that worked here at BP. Obviously, things do change. I mean, some forms of communication now, as we know, have gone to satellite, they're digitised. I wouldn't pretend to comprehend now how the British military do their communications. I do know a little bit about it, but it's way, way above my head these days.
And we've got some live broadcasts at the moment, I believe.
We have, actually. We're actually listening in the background to a 60-metre allocation in the world of amateur radio. And when I say 60 metres, that's the wavelength. It's actually on the 5.3 megs allocation, or thereabouts. It starts around about 5.2 to 5.3. Now, the RSGB, in consultation with Ofcom and the MOD, and the MOD very kindly allowed radio amateurs some 5 or 6 years ago now to have an allocation with a notice of variation upon their licence. So it's a very good form of intercommunication up and down the UK, and indeed further afield. We have one or two countries in the European theatre that have had the allocation, and further afield, and occasionally we speak to those people as well. But primarily, the band that we're actually operating on the 60 metres at the moment is MOD owned, but with their special dispensation, and our thanks, of course, grateful thanks, we're able to enjoy that.
PG3VOT.
Many thanks, George, and look forward to the next QSO with you. G3VOT, G0TBI, stroke portable Bletchley Park, now off and clear, 73.
73, Stuart, thank you for the call.
Bye-bye. Coming up, we have a one-day history and archive course. The next you can book for is on the 9th of December, and it's £20 for a full day learning about Bletchley Park's pre-war history, code-breaking during World War II, and a rare chance to see some of GCHQ's precious historic records held in our archive. On the 11th of October, an event titled Then, Today and Tomorrow focused on women in cybersecurity, or the lack of them. The lunch and talks celebrated the history of women in cybersecurity, looking back at Bletchley Park during World War II, where women outnumbered men by far, But today the industry looks very different. I went along and met Natalie Black, who works for the Cabinet Office and has a very long job title. So your job title is rather baffling. Please start with that and tell me so that we get clear on who you are.
So I'm Deputy Director for Cyber Defence and Public Networks in the Office of Cyber Security and Information Assurance at the Cabinet Office.
Who knew there was even such a thing? So can you tell me a bit about the function of that and what that involves?
So Cabinet Office is responsible for delivery of the National Cyber Security Strategy and the National Cyber Security Programme, which is basically the money to deliver that. The Office of Cyber Security, which is the team that I work in, takes a responsibility for delivering that on a day-to-day basis. So particularly myself, I'm responsible for overseeing policy in relation to public networks, making sure they're safe and secure, and also cyber defence, so the broader look on the public sector, with a particular interest in incident management. So if there's a cyber incident, my team are heavily involved in helping to manage that.
How would you explain what a cyber incident would be in those terms? What sort of thing do you mean?
So it could be anything really, from your computer going down because it's been attacked by malware when you're sat at home at your desk, all the way through to a national cyber incident. So for example, if we were to lose the national grid, if that was to go down. So it really, really varies. But this is all very new space for everyone. So it's a very exciting area to be in because we are really creating the policy and now we're having some really interesting conversations on what are we going to do about cyber in the future.
And so you must be constantly moving to keep up with development in the corporate commercial side of things, whereas you as government need to keep on top of, well, it's like crime, bubbles like water around a rock.
Exactly.
And you're forever trying to catch up with it. Is it kind of, well, along those lines?
It's incredibly fast-paced, which makes it a fascinating area to work in. But also it's increasingly important. So 8% of our GDP now comes from the internet. So we've got to make sure that we can work online in our daily business, but also when we're at home. We've got to make sure that we're safe and secure at the same time.
Compliance must be a really big area for you to keep within the law, because the law is not the fastest moving thing. It's certainly not as fast as commerce and development, and certainly not as fast as people who would try and break through what there is.
Yeah, we're trying to be more creative than that. So the National Cybersecurity Strategy is all about partnership working. So a lot of what we're seeing at this event today, for example, is bringing together private sector, industry, academia, government, but also individuals to all work on cybersecurity together.
And you must want to kind of recruit the brightest brains, because you don't
Absolutely.
Want them to go into the dark side, into where they're finding the back doors and they're finding ways into things.
Absolutely. I mean, again, a purpose of this event today is to highlight what an exciting career cyber is and how many opportunities there are for bright and gifted people. And at the moment, you know, the average person walking down the street probably isn't thinking about a career in cyber, and we're trying to change that.
And the average person walking down the street, be they male or female, there's a real imbalance in this industry. So how did you get into this as a young woman?
So my journey here was probably a little bit unusual. I was lucky enough to have a Fulbright scholarship to go to America, and I studied at Harvard University, and while I was there, cybersecurity was really starting to come on the agenda, and that got me very interested. And then when I came back to the UK, I went to work at the Olympics, where I was Chief of Staff for Security, and cyber was one of the big things that we were worrying about, because it was an internet games. It was providing lots and lots of opportunities, but also some concerns. And so when the games finished, I looked to have a career in cyber and was lucky enough to join the Cabinet Office.
You have a long way to go as well. There's a long road ahead of you. What would you say to young women in particular, as that's what this event is about, considering the notion of cybersecurity as a career?
I think really keep your eyes open, and the opportunities here are endless, and don't limit yourself. It can seem a little bit opaque sometimes, and really the way to overcome that opaqueness is by talking to people. Ask them what they do for their jobs, how did they get there, and there's a really, really great networks emerging. One of them here today is the Women's Security Society, which I'm lucky enough to sit on the board for, and that's a great forum where you can come, meet people who are already in this space, ask them what they like about the job, but also ask them what they don't like about it. And it's the way the world is evolving. So if you're interested in security and wider issues, you should absolutely think about doing some time in cyber.
And is there something that you would give as a free piece of advice to us all, wanting us all to be a little bit safer in our digital lives?
To be honest, it's just being sensible. The problem is we're all very busy people, and so when that update icon comes on our computer to just add that patch, we all say, oh, we'll do it tomorrow. Do it today. And when you're thinking about how you're working online, you know, this stuff is going to be around there for some time. Just be safe about how you use the internet.
Thank you very much. And you can hear more from this event in our next Bletchley Park podcast extra. There really is no predicting who will pop into Bletchley Park and what secrets they'll reveal about what happened here during World War II. In the last few months alone, we've heard Sir Arthur Bonsall telling the tale of why stones were put around the Oval, the Budd children talking about climbing trees and seeing the comings and goings of the codebreakers around the clock, and bomb wrens taken back in time by a recreation of a Bossy Boots warrant officer in Hut 11. Podcast producer Mark Cotton met some women who recalled how the pneumatic conveyor system was used in Block E, not for vital intelligence, but live frogs plucked from the lake.
One of our visitors here today at Bletchley Park, we're very pleased to have here. She is a veteran, Nora. Today she's known as Nora Boswell, but during the Second World War she was Nora Knight. Nora, would you please tell us where you were based and what you did?
I was based at Stairmore, which was one of the outstations for Bletchley, and I was a bomb operator.
You mentioned before this that you came here once before. Would you like to tell us the story behind how you came to Bletchley Park?
I came to Bletchley once because I was sent up on remand because I'd been late three times for duty. And so I had to come and see the chief officer up here.
For a telling off?
For a telling off.
Oh dear.
And so she said to me, well, you must do better than this. And I said, yes, ma'am. And so it said, instead, your next time off after the 12 o'clock shift, you're going to stay at Stanmore and do housework for half the day, and then I hope you'll behave better in future.
And we haven't told you off today.
No.
So, Joyce, this is Block E.
Right.
You probably won't recognise it, but I think this was where you worked from, because this was the communications.
Yeah, you're quite right. I remember I used to creep round the back. There was a loo stuck round the back somewhere and things like that. It looks vaguely familiar. No, I tell you what, I think we did work in a concrete block.
And what was it you did?
Well, I was a teleprinter operator, and I've just realised that they'd got all the coded messages over, and they printed it out in written Morse on green paper. Remember that? Then they sent these things to us in written Morse. We translated it into, I think it was five-digit, it was still in code, five-digit things. And it also said in those messages where they needed to go. And we had, it was like a telephone, and it was teleprinter because it can't be tapped into. Landline, wasn't it?
Yep.
And we sent them out by teleprinter, and sometimes you'd work on the switchboard and you could send a message to five or six RAF stations all over the country, and you could type it out on one teleprinter,
right.
Or if you sent it to one, you know.
And how did the information come into you? How did it arrive in your office?
Anybody remembers the old-fashioned haberdashery stores, and that they used to have this system where you had a little ball and you put it in and pull a thing and it went along wires. So it used to come from the main office in the front, which was manned by men, presumably,
right,
to us. And with the lake just in front of there, they took the frogs out of there, used to put it in with the message, so that when we got it, we opened it up, a frog jumped out at us. Typical man, wasn't it?
Absolutely brilliant. You were saying about that picture on the wall.
Yes, well, it must have been one of those places. It does look familiar to that man, because it's 70 years ago. There was a lovely picture on the wall of a seaside place where a man was selling ice creams and children were playing on the sand and things. And I was there in 1944, and the war had been very long. We'd been through bombing. And this picture on the wall was a real inspiration. It sort of made you feel, oh, there's sanity in the world somewhere. You know, it was like when I was a child, and it was lovely, and you sort of thought, well, maybe we'll get back to that one day. So that was my picture on the wall, and I'm sorry it isn't still there, because I would love to see it.
Yeah.
Oh, we used to have fun, we did. I mean, most of the chaps that were there had done years in Italy and had come back and were really then working up to demob sort of thing. So it wasn't a very dark time. I suppose it was for the beginning, but if you remember in 1945, well, you don't remember, but in 1945, things were definitely looking up after the invasion, and it looked okay all the time then. So we began to
hope, yeah, didn't you?
Yeah. And I remember VE night, I was in Trafalgar Square, there's a picture in there Trafalgar Square, wasn't it? Well, I was in that melee on VE night, but then VJ night, all the chaps, it was very naughty of them, the chaps who were in the men's billets, they all took the furniture out and made a bonfire of it on VJ night. I think they couldn't care less then. The war was over and they thought, we're painting mob, so who cares? I remember that. We used to have nice forks and spoons given to us. We went to the... You were much too posh in the Vens for this. I bet you didn't have a knife, fork and spoon given to you enough to go to the...
No, I got it at the canteen.
Yeah, that's right. They were posh in the Vens.
Huh. And I got into terrible trouble. I was sent to the head officer again because my bedspread, I put it on upside down, and they called me in and said, "Knight, you have sunk a ship."
Oh, they do things like that, don't they? Yeah.
They want
you to put us on the charge if we typed a letter wrong. Yes. And imagine how difficult it is when you don't even know what you're typing about. You could easily put an L. But if you did, you're on a charge, you know. I remember hearing about the atom bomb. We were coming from breakfast and we had a big tank of water where we washed our utensils, as they were called, our knife, fork and spoon. And somebody came up to me and said, "There's been a big new bomb just dropped, you know." And that was the beginning of the atomic age. I remember that, yeah. I was washing my utensils at the wash thing after having breakfast. All these things you remember, don't you?
Nearly 2 hours.
Amazing, because I've never met these people in my life.
Oh, no, really?
Because none of them, we never talk about it. On.
No. Are you all from one society?
No, we're just the Isle of Wight. The coach travel company that operate on the Isle of Wight, and they do 2 trips a year to Bletchley. And, of course, I thought, well, that's the easy way to go.
And to think you both were serving.
Yes.
It's marvellous.
What are we going to look at now?
We're going to look at the newly opened Hut 11. Okay. So they've... as closely as they can, recreate what the bomb rooms look like.
That's how you remember it, is it?
Absolutely. That's where the shells, that's what you had to take them off. Those right. Shells were right behind you. I'd be working here on the bomb, and the shells would be here behind me.
Right.
And you just turn around and take them off.
Take them off.
And do it. Not pleasant. And everyone, you've got your flipping tweezers in your hands.
And here's Zoe Galsing. I'm gonna get lit up when the lights go out in London.
Job up.
Job up, girls. That's right, that's the phrase.
At last. Well done. Strip the machine down as fast as you can. You're moving on to the next menu.
Job up, Amy. Yes. Prayers answered. Just we got typical. The right settings.
Typical bossy woman.
Now,
yes.
Please.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.